Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the August 28th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week is set in front of the White House. In the foreground, there's a tall black chain link fence, kind of obscuring the White House in the background. And Joe Biden is attempting to climb over it. He's got some help from Kamala Harris, who's giving him a leg up, and they're both facing back towards the viewer. Biden with a little wave with one hand and one hand on the fence. The headline is "A Convention Boost: Democrats Make Their Case for Replacing Trump in the White House." I think we have a couple stories on that, starting with the first main story. Democrats make their case for Biden. What happened? Democrats formally nominated Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as their presidential ticket this week at the virtual convention featuring a parade of both Democratic and Republican speakers praising Biden's decency and empathy and calling President Trump unfit to lead. Having scrapped plans to gather in Milwaukee, Democrats pivoted to a heavily produced convention with rapid-fire appearances from dozens of participants, plus a colorful roll call panorama featuring delegates showing off distinctive scenery in 50 states and 7 territories, including the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, fried calamari in Rhode Island, saguaro cacti in Arizona, and a field of cows in Montana. The speaker lineup showcased Biden's broad coalition. Republicans such as former Ohio Governor John Kasich and Arizona Senator John McCain's widow, Cindy, along with Senator Bernie Sanders, who said Trump's re-election would be a terrible blow to the progressive movement and the country. "The future of our democracy is at stake," Sanders said. "The price of failure is just too great to imagine." Biden maintains about an 8-point lead in aggregations of national polls, although the pre-convention CNN poll had his lead cut to 4. In convention speeches, Democrats highlighted Trump's efforts to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, the COVID-19 death toll, now over 170,000, and the pandemic's economic fallout. But the central focus was on character, with videos of Biden greeting Amtrak conductors and an elevator operator, and grieving after family tragedies. The Week went to press before Harris and Biden made their addresses, but in early remarks, Biden criticized Trump's pandemic response, saying, "I used to think it was because he was callous, but I think it's because he's just not smart enough." Michelle Obama echoed the dig, saying, "Trump is clearly in over his head. He cannot meet this moment." What the columnist said: "The Democrats' urgency to remove Trump from the Oval Office has forged a temporary truce between centrists and progressives," said Eric Locke in the NewYorker.com. In the run-up to the convention, progressives complained about the screen time awarded to party elders like Bill Clinton, while rising star Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez got just 60 seconds. But Democrats clearly fear a repeat of 2016, when Sanders' embittered supporters failed to rally behind Hillary Clinton. To keep the disparate factions under one tent, the party went light on policy talk and focused on Trump. "It sure made for dull television," said David Harsanyi in NationalReview.com. "The convention had a 1980s telethon vibe with pre-recorded speeches, canned applause, actresses serving as MCs, and video packages that could easily have been Budweiser Super Bowl commercials circa 2005. Without a crowd cheering every line, the vacuity of it all was even more conspicuous. The Democrats' convention message was clear. Donald Trump bad, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. Viewers who sat through hours of tedious Obama administration nostalgia were left wondering, what do Democrats stand for? For now, Democrat spirits are buoyed by the polls, said Scott Martell in the Los Angeles Times. But they also point to a danger, a lack of passionate support for Biden. Pew found that 56% of voters cite opposition to Trump as their main reason for backing Biden, whereas just 19% of Trump supporters are driven by dislike for his opponent. With early voting just 6 weeks away in several states, anti-Trump anger might not be enough to sustain Biden's lead when he comes under Republican attack. Michelle Obama pinpointed exactly how Democrats feel right now, said Michelle Norris in WashingtonPost.com. As gifted an orator as her husband, Obama spoke with calm, confident intensity, and offered a masterclass in flipping sexist and racist stereotypes about angry black women on their head. She cataloged Trump's egregious failings, particularly in dealing with the pandemic, and then powerfully finished, he simply cannot be who we need him to be for us. Pausing to sigh before adding, it is what it is. The line was an allusion to Trump's grotesquely callous dismissal of soaring coronavirus deaths and summarized what's at stake in November. Trump is who he is, and he won't change unless the fall election delivers him a change of address. Before we move on, I'm going to read you one of the It Wasn't All Bad pieces. At 103 years of age, Dorothy Pollock decided to check an item off her bucket list, a frog tattoo. Pollock had been living in a retirement home, but her grandson pulled her out when he found he couldn't even take her out for a burger and beer on her birthday. After being in COVID-19 prison, I thought it was time to start living again, Pollock said. So earlier this month, Teresa Jones, her grandson's girlfriend, took her to a tattoo parlor in Muskegon, Michigan, as a celebration of her newfound freedom. After getting inked, Pollock hopped on the back of Jones' friend's motorcycle to check off another aspiration. The next goal on her list? Skydiving. Controversy of the week. Kamala Harris, will she give Biden's campaign a boost? The process was long and winding, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post, but Joe Biden finally got it right last week in picking Senator Kamala Harris to be his 2020 running mate. It's not just that Harris, 55, a five-term congresswoman and former attorney general of California, is eminently qualified to serve as president if the 77-year-old Biden doesn't complete a full term or steps down after one. Harris' gender and ethnicity, as the daughter of Jamaican and Indian immigrants, she's the first woman of color on a major party ticket, will invigorate Biden's skeptical progressives, while her own pragmatic, moderate credentials should soothe the ideological anxiety of mainstream voters worried Biden might be a Trojan horse for the radical left. Harris is also a battle-tested national campaigner, said Bart Jansen in USA Today. Biden learned firsthand how this former prosecutor can land a punch on the debate stage when she went after him on his opposition in the 1970s to school busing. Harris' Senate grillings of Jeff Sessions, Brett Kavanaugh, and William Barr, meanwhile, are the stuff of Democratic legend. If she brings that same fire to the Democratic ticket, in particular to her debate with the ever-evasive Mike Pence. Biden's safe but inspired choice of running mate could well be decisive in November. If Harris is a good campaigner, said Matt Purple in the AmericanConservative.com, why did her own campaign go so horribly wrong? She entered the race in January 2019 as Biden's most viable challenger, polling a healthy 15% in the 24-candidate field. By December, though, she was at 4%, thanks to incoherent, shifting positions on Medicare for All and police reform, and generally having proved herself too liberal for the moderates and not liberal enough for the left. Harris' legendary verbal combat skills are also wildly overrated, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. Just consider her interrogation of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Democrats still swoon over the supposedly masterful moment when Harris asked a bewildered Kavanaugh about his secret contacts with the Kasowitz law firm, which represented Donald Trump. Kavanaugh denied it, and Harris dropped the matter. As we also saw in the debates, Harris throws a lot of punches, but it's all for effect. She has no follow-through. Nor is she any kind of moderate, said Kyle Smith in NationalReview.com. Harris has long advocated single-payer health care and says illegal immigrants should be covered by it for free. She's also fully on board with the socialistic Green New Deal and would happily destroy the filibuster and expand and pack the Supreme Court to get it passed. At the same time, Harris doesn't excite many people on the left, said Tiana Lowe in Washington Examiner. They're well aware that as California's attorney general, Harris aggressively prosecuted nonviolent drug crime and used prisoners to fight wildfires for a dollar a day. Actually, Biden's choice of Harris was a smart tactical move, said Manisha Sinha in the New York Times. And to an Indian American woman like me, it feels like a personal gift. After 8 years of the Obama presidency, the open racism and anti-immigrant animus Trump brought to the White House has been deeply alarming to all people of color. The charismatic Harris represents the very groups mocked and vilified by Trump, women, black people, and immigrants, and will energize those voters. At the same time, a Biden-Harris ticket represents the cosmopolitan, interracial democracy that a majority of Americans aspire to live in today. This is our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for nature. After a bald eagle attacked a high-tech government drone in flight and sent it plunging into Lake Michigan, Julia Ponder of the University of Minnesota's Raptor Center said the eagle is the king of the skies and probably felt its territory was being invaded. It was a good week for cattle, with new research by conservationists in Botswana that lions are less likely to attack a cow if it has a pair of large eyes painted on its buttocks, which fools predators into thinking they've been spotted. The eye trick, researchers said, is a useful addition to the carnivore livestock conflict prevention toolbox. And it was a good week for benevolent narcissism after actor Dennis Quaid adopted a kitten named Dennis Quaid from a Virginia animal shelter after seeing a TV news report on the orphaned feline. I'm out to save all the Dennis Quaids of the world, Quaid declared. But it was a bad week for love letters after the Senate Intelligence Committee released several fawning letters that Donald Trump wrote to Russian dictator Vladimir Putin before Trump became president. As you probably heard, I am a big fan of yours, Trump wrote in 2007, adding that Putin definitely deserves being named Time's Man of the Year. It was a bad week for self-incrimination with the drunk driving arrest of a British man whose Range Rover had lost a wheel and bore a bumper sticker reading, "I'm not drunk, just avoiding potholes." If Finally, it was a bad week for transparency with the launch in Tokyo of public toilets with see-through walls. The walls become opaque when the door is locked, but regain their transparency upon the user's exit, thus fostering a spirit of hospitality for the next person. Short news piece before we move on. A court victory for transgender rights. A federal judge this week temporarily blocked a Trump administration rule that would have rolled back Affordable Care Act protections for transgender people against discrimination from hospitals, doctors, and health insurance providers. Judge Frederick Block found that the administration's new rules appear to contradict a Supreme Court decision made in June, 3 days after the rule was finalized, that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 protects transgender workers from discrimination in the workplace. The 2010 ACA included much the same language as the 1964 Act in also prohibiting discrimination on the basis of race, religion, national origin, and sex. Administration lawyers had argued that the word sex should not extend to transgender people. We're on the briefing page. The title is China's War on Religion. To secure its hold on power, the Communist Party is tightening its control over all faiths in China. When did the crackdown begin? Religious repression has intensified across China since President Xi Jinping took office in 2013. The brutal crackdown on minority Muslims in the northwest region of Xinjiang, where mosques and madrasas are being demolished and more than 1 million Uyghurs have been detained in re-education camps, has sparked international outrage. But the Communist Party's assault on faith is not limited to Islam. Authorities have used the world's distraction over the coronavirus pandemic to accelerate an ongoing campaign against Christianity. Officially atheist, the party sees adherence to any faith, particularly those with foreign origins such as Christianity and Islam, as a threat to its dominance. So Xi has embarked on the cynicization of religious practice, ordering Muslim, Buddhist, and Christian leaders to integrate Chinese communist thought into their belief systems. The party wants people to love the motherland and their faith, says Yu Quan, head of the body that oversees ethnic and religious affairs in China. Cynicization has resulted in thousands of churches and mosques being shuttered and razed. Those that remain fly Chinese flags. How is Christianity practiced in China? For decades, Chinese Catholics and Protestants have been divided between those who attend state-sanctioned churches, in which clerics are appointed by Beijing, and those who attend so-called underground churches. About half of China's 12 million Catholics worship in the underground churches loyal to the Vatican. To try to heal that schism, Beijing and the Vatican struck a deal in 2018 that gave Chinese authorities the right to recommend new bishops and the Pope the power to approve or veto them. Beijing has exploited that agreement by refusing to name bishops to half of China's 98 dioceses while pressuring priests to adhere to party regulations, saying that the Vatican Pact means that the Pope commands them to do so. Portraits of the Virgin Mary have been replaced by portraits of Xi, and priests have been compelled to incorporate Xi's sayings into their sermons. What about Protestant churches? Protestantism is China's fastest growing religion, and so is especially worrisome to Xi. the state-registered church, the Three Self Patriotic Movement, claims some 39 million adherents. But at least another 40 million are thought to worship in underground home churches, pushing the share of Chinese who are Protestants to nearly 6%, about the same as the membership of the Communist Party. Beijing is determined to control the faith. Online bookstores have been banned from selling Bibles as authorities prepare a new Mandarin translation that some fear will omit whole chapters. Pastors have been ordered to attend government-sponsored training sessions where they are told that in China, the state leads and the church follows. Thousands of underground churches have been closed. At those that remain open, symbols of faith have been purged, with crosses and Bibles burned. Facial recognition cameras have been installed so that the authorities can track and harass worshipers, a tactic pioneered against Buddhists in the autonomous Chinese province of Tibet. What happened in Tibet? Tibetan Buddhism has been targeted by Beijing for decades because it is a central pillar of Tibetan identity. That repression has ramped up under Xi. Tens of thousands of party members have been deployed to temples and villages under an outreach initiative that doubles as a surveillance program. And since 2016, up to 17,000 Buddhist monks and nuns have been evicted from two key training institutes and sent to indoctrination centers where, the U.S. State Department reports, they were beaten and shocked with electric batons. Shen Kuang-go, the Politburo member who oversaw the Tibet crackdown, was sent to Xinjiang in 2016 to use the same playbook against the Uyghur Muslims. Detainees are forced to say, "There is no God, there is only the Communist Party," said Omar Kanat, head of the U.S.-based Uyghur Human Rights Project. Are other religious groups being repressed? The Hui, a Muslim minority of some 10 million people in central China, are now suffering the same fate as the Uyghurs. Their mosques are being sinicized, stripped of domes and minarets, and the call to prayer has been banned. Many Hui fear the concentration camps may come next. The only faith that remains relatively free in Chinese is Chinese Buddhism, which is seen as indigenous. Still, it too is being pressed into party service. In 2018, the Shaolin Monastery, birthplace of Kung Fu, was forced to fly the Chinese national flag for the first time in its 1,500-year history. How has the U.S. responded? The Trump administration has sanctioned dozens of companies and governmental bodies connected to the human rights abuses in Xinjiang. And last month, Chen and three other top officials were hit with sanctions under the Global Magnitsky Act, freezing their U.S. assets and banning American companies from doing business with them. "The U.S. will not stand by," said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, as the Communist Party attempts to eradicate Uyghurs, culture, and Muslim faith. "But outside pressure is unlikely to alter Chinese policy," said Carrie Kozel, an expert on religion in China. "The state," she says, "sees religion as an existential threat." And we'll read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with "Lockdowns Aren't Killing the Economy." "America is largely open for business, but consumers are still staying home," said Scott Gottlieb and Michael Strain. 36 states have lifted or relaxed bans on large gatherings. 33 have opened bars, and every state has restarted at least some non-essential businesses. but economic activity remains depressed, and consumers' fear of the virus appears to be the primary factor. Many economists believe the loss of millions of jobs in March was driven by public worries about getting sick, not by lockdown orders. Labor demand dropped equally across states, regardless of when lockdown orders were imposed. Many job losses were in retail, airlines, and personal care businesses that anxious consumers avoided, avoidance that has continued as government restrictions have largely ended. That means the fate of the economy this fall and winter depends on controlling spread. Because a return to stay-at-home orders is unlikely, we must rely on prudence in personal interactions, more widespread mask wearing, and extensive testing and isolation to keep the virus under control. If we fail at these measures, we face a lot of tragic death and disease, and the very real possibility that the economy could tip back into recession. Deliberately accelerating climate change. Trump administration officials know they may only have a few months left in office, said Paul Waldman, so they're doubling the pace of their efforts to despoil the environment and accelerate climate change. This week, Interior Secretary David Bernhardt announced he will open the pristine wilderness of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas drilling, a goal long sought by the oil industry. The week before, the administration removed regulations on oil and gas companies' leaks of methane, a very potent greenhouse gas, at drilling sites. These pro-carbon emissions policies come at a time when Earth's climate is getting undeniably hotter, with soaring temperatures setting new records from Phoenix to Washington, D.C. So why promote more emissions now? The lobbyists, grifters, and far-right ideologues who fill this administration's top jobs are acutely aware they may be returning to oil companies and private industry come January, and are trying to do everything possible to advance their interests. If Trump loses, the 10 weeks between election and inauguration will probably bring a long list of horrors on the environment, as well as on immigration and health care. Reversing the damage done in this dark period may take a long time. This from India. Harris embodies our American dream. Kamala Harris became the pride of India overnight, said the Hindustan Times. The presumptive Democratic vice presidential nominee was raised in California by her Desi mother, and though Harris' father is Jamaican and she is seen as a black American, India can rejoice in her achievement. Her nomination represents the political pinnacle of the Indian American community's meteoric rise in the United States. Though they number only 4.5 million, Indian Americans are the most highly educated and the most wealthy ethnic group in the U.S. In a single generation, they have produced two state governors, Nikki Haley of South Carolina and Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, both Republicans, as well as five members of Congress. Of course, we should have no illusions that having one of our daughters in high office will reap foreign policy dividends for India. While Harris, who visited here often as a child, is more familiar with India than most Americans, she is not necessarily more sympathetic to its government. To the left of Joe Biden politically, she likely has a skeptical view of India's rightward political turn under Prime Minister Narendra Modi. But who cares? If elected, Harris will be a heartbeat away from the world's most powerful office, an Indian living the American dream. And this is a business column. A marriage neither of us can leave. The United States and China are not in a cold war, said Zachary Carabel. They are in a bad marriage with no current option for divorce. Forget the facile analogies between today's discord and the rivalry between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. The Chinese-U.S. economic relationship is so much more connected and intertwined than the U.S.-Soviet one ever was. During those Cold War decades, trade between the two countries was all but non-existent. By contrast, even with President Trump's tariffs, bilateral trade in goods between the U.S. and China is expected to be around $450 billion to $500 billion this year. China also holds $1.1 trillion in U.S. securities, while hundreds of billions of dollars worth of capital stock or factories in China are owned or maintained by U.S. companies. This economic superfusion since China joined the World Trade Organization has its pitfalls. U.S. manufacturing has taken a hit, but consumers have benefited from cheaper products that made middle-class life more affordable. So why does the language of the Cold War still persist? It's true that bickering between the countries has certainly gotten worse, but unless either China or the U.S. finds a spare $5 to $10 trillion to rebuild completely independent supply chains, we will still need each other. Our in-depth article this week, the last word feature, is called Choosing to Be Alone. Before COVID, young South Koreans were already escaping social pressures by staying home, said journalist Ann Babe in restofworld.org. Now others are following them into an increasingly isolated culture. The day Kim Hyman threw up on the job while working as a graphic designer at a small broadcasting firm in Seoul, she was so overwhelmed by stress that it made her sick to her stomach. When a senior coworker shamed her for being just a few minutes late, it echoed what she had heard from older South Koreans all her life. She wasn't good enough. At lunchtime, she made a run for the restroom stall. The criticisms kept building up, she says, until she reached the point where she didn't think she could take it anymore. For 26-year-old Hai Min, as for many young South Koreans, life choices feel forced and fixed, and not like actual choices at all. Many feel so beaten down by the rigid social and professional demands of their country that they refer to it as Hell Joseon, a play on Korea's old dynastic name. The path is especially bleak for young women who must contend with the nation's deeply rooted misogyny. Deviation from the mainstream is widely viewed as disobedient, and sometimes, in the eyes of older generations, even unpatriotic. It's something to do with Korean society, Hai Min says. There's only one way to engage in relationships with others, or one type of person who's considered acceptable. And for people like me, it's really hard. Jaime never understood why she should have to rush through a school system that did nothing but judge and rank her, only to find a lifelong position at a company that would do the same. She dropped out of university for a year before transferring, sought counseling for her battered self-esteem, and quit her job, despite knowing that all these choices would be looked upon as failures. Perhaps toughest of all, Hai Min knew that even if she were to achieve success, it was unlikely she'd be compensated fairly for it. South Korea's gender wage gap is the worst in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, with men earning an average of 32.5% more than women. Her parents would ask, Hai Min, Why can't you be like other women your age and find a nice man and get married? Hymen, however, has no plans to get married, nor does she expect to have children. After years of being told she must strive to be a good student, good employee, good wife, and good mother, she eventually decided she no longer wanted to partake in a system that ties her social currency and self-worth to such a punishing status quo. So Hymen opted out. Why do I have to continue on going through these difficulties, she says. For what? In traditionally collectivist South Korea, individualist loners, or hongjak, are becoming increasingly common. The term, which translates to a lone tribe, shortens and combines meaning by itself and tribe. I'm sorry, there were some symbols here written in Korean that I don't know how to translate. It's used to be described a group of people who prefer, out of pleasure or practicality, and often utter exhaustion and sheer desperation, to live outside of conventional social structures and simply be alone. Within South Korea's hyperactive cyberculture of online forums, blogs, and social media, an entire taxonomy has sprung up to classify, in ever greater details, various hongjak identities and activities. Many hongjak or honyo, or solitary women, and some honyo, like Hymen, are bihan, meaning they reject marriage and often child-rearing. There are also 4Bs, who take the ethos even further by rejecting sex and romantic relationships. When hongjak eat alone, it's called honbap, and when they drink alone, it's called honsul. They can also play alone, honmo, which might include traveling alone, honhang, going to the movies alone, honi-yong, or shopping alone, honsho. All of this contributes to a booming hon economy. Banks offer single household credit cards, bars and restaurants promise solo patrons judgment-free service, and honjak-specific establishments set partitioned tables just for them. Specialized karaoke joints feature individual coin-operated booths. Cinemas install single-seat aisles. TV shows like I Live Alone and Drinking Solo portray hongjak life, and news sites like One Economy News exclusively cover single living. While some hongjak embrace the hon and truly go it alone, others turn to the jok, the tribe of people like them, for support and validation. In communities both online and off, members strive to normalize the hongjak life as a sign of modern times, a decision that is sensible and convenient, and if not something to celebrate, then at very least nothing to be embarrassed about. The hongjak would need or want to look to others while isolating themselves may seem like something of a paradox. Yet for many young hongjak, the appeal lies in partaking in a sort of shared identity while under pressure from status-obsessed country, says Andrew Ongi Kim, a sociology professor at Korea University. If you don't meet mainstream standards, you feel ashamed. With hongjak, there's a sense of being a member of a group. On King of Hongjak, a community app and website, solitaries post photos of their daily lives, shop the marketplace for hongjak wares, and peruse articles like "The Trend These Days Is I Live Alone" and other content created specifically for them. They occasionally meet in person at King of Hongjak events. 34-year-old co-founder Oh Jung-hee, who has been hongyo for the past decade and sees her friends in person 2 to 3 times a year, says that in a society oriented toward families and couples, she started King of Hongjak to help voluntary outsiders like her lead better lives. Whether they use it to be independent alone or independent together is up to them. Kim Min Jung, a 34-year-old YouTuber, runs the channel One Person, Two Cats. Minjung says her vlogs about her Bihan life are meant to encourage women who want to pursue a similar lifestyle but don't know how. Society doesn't view Bihan as a type of lifestyle, she says. It views it as an unfinished lifestyle. Other Bihan have even showcased their solo marriage ceremonies on social media in order to inspire women who want to stay single but still get the wedding gifts. While Haimin's parents had always told her that she was the only person who felt the way she did, she suspected that wasn't true. Surely there were others like her searching for alternatives. In 2017, around the time she quit her job at the broadcasting company, she started channeling her thoughts into drawings and designs and created a cartoon documenting her struggles. After months of deliberating over whether to post them, she finally decided to do it. In 2018, Haimin launched her Instagram account with the handle @nicetoneet and the pseudonym Nuguna, meaning anyone in Korean. Her first drawing was of a girl curled up in a near fetal position. There were no captions or hashtags. She hit share and waited for people's reactions. When I finally uploaded, it was a release of all the feelings and thoughts I had inside, she reflected. I felt like I was being a whistleblower, like I was telling everyone the truth. Over time, Haimin grew more outspoken, with her cartoons addressing society's incessant questioning about graduation, employment, and marriage. At every step, her protagonist tried to find her own way in the world and not simply do what was expected of her. One post depicted her stopping at a convenience store to buy alcohol to drink at home by herself. Another pictured a battery pack with the words, "The world was quiet and calm when I was alone in my own room. Like an old battery, I spent my energy quickly and charged slowly. I stayed until I was charged, and nobody judged my life. I loved this space and time." At first, so many commenters accused Haimin of being lazy, weak, selfish, and a bad role model that she almost gave up on the project. She also felt a little guilty about it. "I still wasn't sure if it was okay to live as my own identity," she says. But within 3 months, she'd amassed about 20,000 followers, which proved to her that it was. In 2019, after many months of savings, Haimin moved out of her parents' home and got her own studio apartment on a quiet street in a popular student area. The idea of leading a life on her own terms, with her own routines and rituals, came as a relief. Haimin's compact 180-square-foot walk-up is on the top floor of an old building whose best feature is its rooftop. Using the Hanjak section of an app called Today House, she bought a twin-size bed that folds up against the wall, a mini microwave, and an air fryer, the perfect size for making a meal for one. She painted the walls slate gray, then hung a heart-shaped mirror and a cloud-shaped neon light. Most days, Haimin fills her time drawing. She now has close to 40,000 followers and has published her webtoons in a 2-volume book. When her working day is done, she'll watch one of her favorite shows, such as I Live Alone, or whatever YouTube suggests, usually beauty tutorials and daily vlogs. When Haimin craves the spark of human energy, she'll go to a cafe or the cinema or coin karaoke by herself, or will head up to a roof to look at the surrounding thrum of the city. The rise of the Hanjak phenomenon has coincided with several worrying health and demographic trends. Since 2014, the number of young people in South Korea receiving treatment for depression has nearly doubled. In addition to increasing youth unemployment, the marriage rate and birth rate are at all-time lows. If nothing changes, according to the government projections in 2014, South Korea will undergo natural extinction by 2750. Despite such warnings, South Korea's economy is now shifting toward a kinds of technologies and that support a Hong Jok lifestyle. Even before the country became the epicenter of COVID-19 outside of China, businesses had been developing a robust digital infrastructure for contactless interactions. This nascent untapped industry, a combination of un and contact, enables customers to do things like order food, schedule taxis, make payments, and send gifts without any human interaction at all. More and more restaurants and cafes have replaced flesh and blood wait staff with self-service kiosks and robots. On a national scale, the government is staking the country's economic reform and job creation on untapped. In May, the president announced the South Korean New Deal, a $64 billion program focused on investing in technologies that power contactless interactions, including remote work systems, high-speed internet, and 5G, and self-driving cars, drones, robots, and other AI initiatives. Such developments underscore the government's public campaign of everyday life quarantine, its vision for a socially distanced future where regulations will be relaxed, but people will still be reminded that they should not go back to their pre-COVID-19 ways. As Kim, the sociologist, puts it, the government constantly says, you need to practice social distancing. They are indirectly saying, practice the Hong Jok lifestyle. It seems that Hong Jok, even if accidentally, anticipated the kind of contactless society that may soon be the norm. Indeed, for Haimin, the reality ahead doesn't look wildly different from life before the pandemic, at least in the day-to-day, hour-by-hour, minute-by-minute sense. After COVID-19 struck, she says, I just thought to myself, well, there's nothing much I can do, and headed home, watched YouTube videos, read books, and went on my smartphone as I would normally do. It wasn't until later, when she was talking to a friend on the phone, that Haimin realized how disruptive COVID-19 had been for those who don't identify with Hong Jok. Of course, things have changed for Haimin, too. She worries about community transmission and her parents' health. She wears masks and sanitizes her hands. At some point, she put a stop to her already infrequent visits to cafes, cinemas, and other crowded public spaces. Yet while the social restrictions were hard for many South Koreans, following them came naturally to Haimin. She already thought of her space as a sanctuary, and for the foreseeable future, she thinks she'll be happy staying at home by herself. This was adapted from a story that originally appeared in restofworld.org. We'll pick up one of the health and science articles. A clue to why some people don't get sick. Evidence is mounting that many people may be partly resistant to the coronavirus because their immune systems have been primed to recognize and fight off similar infections. Scientists suspect that memory T cells could be the key to this immune response. The working theory is that previous battles with related coronaviruses, such as the four that caused the common cold, may have taught T cells how to ward off the new virus. Researchers say this might explain some curious trends in the epidemiology of the pandemic, including why some 40% of infected people develop no symptoms. One recent U.S. study found that T cells in blood donated from 2015 and 2018, long before the coronavirus even existed, appeared to recognize the virus when presented with it. Researchers in other countries report similar findings. In a recent study from Singapore, 50% of uninfected people had T cells that react to the coronavirus. Some scientists think that because T cells typically last for years, they might ultimately prove more important in the fight against COVID-19 than antibodies, which may survive only a couple of months. The immune system is basically a memory machine. Alessandro Sett from Southern California's La Jolla Institute for Immunology tells the Washington Post, it remembers and fights back stronger. And we'll turn on over to finish out on the Talking Points page. This article is called QAnon, Now in the GOP Mainstream. With racist conspiracy monger Marjorie Taylor Greene headed to Congress, Republicans are becoming the QAnon Party, said Max Boot in WashingtonPost.com. Greene won a House primary race last week in a deep red Georgia district, making her a general election shoe-in despite being an avowed follower of QAnon, an online cult that believes President Trump leads a secret effort to expose and imprison a network of deep state child sex traffickers. She's spoken of a global cabal of Satan-worshipping pedophiles and calls Q, a supposed U.S. intelligence official who posts anonymous clues on far-right message boards, a patriot. More than 50 congressional candidates promoted QAnon this year, including Joe Ray Perkins, Oregon's GOP Senate nominee. After Greene's victory, Trump called her a future Republican star and a real winner. Most political parties have an outlandish fringe that marinates in paranoia, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com. The spread of QAnon, however, shows that the Trump-era GOP has weakened antibodies against kookery. Q appeals to Trump supporters in particular because it promotes a radical distrust of traditional sources of information. Trump and his sons retweet QAnon accounts, and his former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn is a pledged member. Greene's nuttiness goes beyond Q, said Jeremy Beeman in WashingtonExaminer.com. She's an Islamophobe who insists Barack Obama is a Muslim, traffics in anti-Semitic tropes, and claims no plane crashed into the Pentagon on 9/11. Ultimately, Trump avoids disavowing QAnon fanatics for the same reason liberals tolerate the anarchists attacking Portland and other cities. They want the votes. QAnon's growth is alarming, said Justin Ling in foreignpolicy.com. It uses Christian-themed messaging to plant dangerous, sometimes violent, delusions with its followers. Many people are complaining that the conspiracy is destroying their personal relationships with husbands, wives, and even mothers, spending hours a day online indulging their Q obsession. We've reached a QAnon tipping point, said Charles Wartzel in NYTimes.com. A leaked internal Facebook study found there are more than 3 million members of QAnon groups. In April, a knife-wielding Q follower was arrested while driving to take out Joe Biden. With Greene going to Congress, a niche online conspiracy theory has finally metastasized into a legitimate threat to safety and even democracy. We've got time for a few shorter pieces. Starting with, as many of the nation's schools go viral, nearly 17 million children live in homes without high-speed internet service, and more than 7 million lack computers, according to a report by a consortium of civil rights and education groups. The issue disproportionately affects Black, Latino, and Native American students and those in the South and in rural communities. One out of four Americans between 18 and 24 said they've considered suicide during the pandemic, according to a survey by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Among respondents of all ages, 40% reported suffering from mental or behavioral health issues related to the pandemic, including anxiety, depression, and stress disorders. Over on the Poll Watch, 54% of Americans approve of Joe Biden's pick of Senator Kamala Harris for vice president, including 86% of Democrats and 52% of independents. Among Republicans, 25% approve of the choice and 55% don't. 75% of Americans believe it's likely that Russia or other foreign government will interfere in the upcoming elections, including 62% of Republicans and 88% of Democrats. 78% of Democrats, but just 37% of Republicans, think such interference is a major problem. And let's see, we'll finish out with a quote today. This one comes from G.K. Chesterton, quoted in artsjournal.com. He says, "A Puritan is a person who pours righteous indignation into the wrong thing." And another short one from Augustine of Hippo says, "Lord, make me chaste, but not yet." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.